Good evening, everyone. This is host Terry Lynn Coop on the Blue Plate Special, and I am just totally geeking out to be serving up Bryn Chandler on tonight's episode. Bryn is a former professional Santa's helper and beauty school dropout who was best known for her work on TV animation during the 80s and 90s, better known as the Golden Age of Geekiness. She worked on everything from He-Man and the Masters of the Universe to Gargoyles, Transformers, Mutant Ninja Turtles, My Little Pony, and the one and only utterly classic Batman the Animated Series, which is the one that she copped an Emmy nomination for. So that's where we're going to start. How are you doing tonight, Bryn?
I'm just fine. How are you?
I am absolutely fantastic. Thank you for coming on the show.
Anytime.
So how did you end up as a woman neck deep in geek culture?
Well, I met my husband, Michael, my ex-husband, Michael Reeves, at a fantasy con. And a few months later moved to L.A. to be with him. And after a few months, the phone rang one morning. It was Arthur Nadell at Filmation calling to ask if Michael wanted to write for He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, which was just starting up. Michael said, would you be willing to read a spec script? Arthur said, if you can get it to me before I leave on Friday. And Michael said, it'll be there. He hung up the phone, turned to me and said, you've got to write a script now. And I had never done it. And this was Thursday morning. So I gathered up all his old scripts that I could find, read them, taught myself, you know, as much as I could, would run into the room and say, what do you call it when a spaceship goes zoom? And he would tell me. And so I did 16 hours, slept for 4 hours, did another 16 hours. And on Friday afternoon, we could not get my Apple computer to talk to my IBM Selectronic printer. So we packed the whole computer up in the car, drove it from West Hollywood to Northridge to Michael's friend, Diane Duane. And I was wadded up under the kitchen towel, sobbing, and Diane worked her magic, and kitchen table sobbing. Diane worked her magic, and we got it printed out, brought it to Arthur Nadell at Filmation. He glanced at it, dropped it on the floor next to his desk, and I thought, well, that was fun. So Monday morning, he called first thing and said, tell me the truth, Michael, did you write this yourself? So I guess I did it okay, and that started not only my animation career, but my lifelong friendship with Diane Duane, which is even better.
Definitely.
So
anybody who can get your printer, anybody who can get your printer to work is someone you need to have in your life.
Diane was building her own computers probably in like 1960. I mean, she's just the most one of the most brilliant people I've ever met. So
when you're giving me your bio, you were telling me the script that you wrote for Masters of the Universe was featured as part
mm-hmm.
of when the show actually launched at Mann's Chinese Theater.
It was. And that was a huge education for me, actually, because only the A-list, they closed Hollywood Boulevard. They had bodybuilders. They had futuristic cars. They had mock fights between Skeletor and He-Man and everything. But only the A-listers were allowed to sit in the main theater with Arthur and Adele and with the voice actors and people like that. I sat with the below-the-line crew, as they call them, in a smaller theater. But the cool thing about that is that I was surrounded by children. So somebody's child, someone I don't think I've ever met, climbed into my lap. So I got to watch my first ever script air on a movie-sized screen with children. And boy, if you think that you don't learn how to write dialogue when your favorite line falls dead, it was the best thing ever, the best education I could get. And written dialogue is different. Written dialogue is different than spoken dialogue. And
that's why
Ray Bradbury. Yeah, go ahead.
What is it like in animation, like with comic books? Does the script come first, or is there a story treatment, or what's the process?
First, usually, I don't know, this may have changed, but in the old school days, first you do a one-line idea. Then comes a one paragraph pitch, then a 1 to 3 page premise, then an outline, then two drafts of the script. If they ask for more than that, they have to pay you. So a lot of times, as my career went on, story editors would come to me and they would give me the idea and say, I want you to do this. Arthur Nadel at Filmation also spoiled me. He'd have a cattle call where he calls a whole bunch of writers in, and he would say to me, okay, before you get started, Bryn, I want you to write a story about Tila, and I don't know, it should have cheeseburgers in it or whatever. And I would say, okay. And he'd say, okay, you can go. And I'd go home and I'd give him what he wanted while everybody else in the room had to pitch in front of each other. So he protected
That's awesome.
Me from that. Yeah, it crippled me a little bit, but I'm still grateful. I still hate pitching more than anything. Thank God I don't have to do it.
I mean, we'll start with He-Man here. I don't know if you actually understand the power of He-Man to this day in pop culture geekdom.
I don't know. I don't know that I've actually seen any of my episodes. It just astounds me that people are still talking about this.
I mean, I sold He-Man action figures last week.
Wow.
It's undergone a complete renaissance of and coming back around in popularity. And, you know, this list of stories of shows you gave me, my eyes are just popping. I mean, Transformers, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the original My Little Ponies. I mean, and look at the My Little Pony franchise, what it's morphed into today with Friendship is Magic.
Yep. Well, the first person I met in L.A., Michael picked me up at the airport, and we drove straight to the home of David Wise, who is best known for giving the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles their distinctive personalities. Because in the comics, they were all just emo, all of them. They looked and sounded exactly alike. Yeah, so David did that, and he wrote 80 episodes of Turtles, and I know that because he will tell you that every single time he sees you.
Every single time.
Every single time. I love you, David.
And it was the animated series of TMNT that, yes, that established the franchise. I mean, I know
and
the comic started it, but that was the that was the franchise that lives to this day. I mean, if I have Mutant Ninja Turtle paraphernalia, it's like torn out of my hands, you know, by collectors. But you were part of it too. You wrote scripts for Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yes. Yeah, I only did 3.
Doesn't matter.
But yeah, I was all through this time. I was also having a lot of babies and stuff. So there are gaps.
even better. So that's totally cool. And then the one where you got your nomination for, which is one of the strongest franchises, is what was it like to work on Batman the Animated Series?
That was amazing. This was, of course, Michael Reeves was story editing, and Paul Dini I had known from the first days at Filmation. So we'd known each other forever, and it was a character I grew up reading the comic books. So I felt like I knew them right off the bat. So it was always hard being the only girl, but it couldn't get too rough because people like Paul Dini and Marty Pasco, this was also my social circle. So you couldn't be too awful to each other at work because you'd get smacked around at dinner. So that was that was helpful. But everybody talks about, I wrote most of the Batgirl episodes, and everybody talks about how strong she was. And my big frustration on that show was that they wouldn't let me make her even stronger. Because I tried.
Batgirl is an amazing character in BTAS. She truly is. Yeah. And so you said you wrote most of the Batgirl episodes. That's fantastic.
Yeah. And I really tried to make her, here she is, this teenage girl, and she's running around being a superhero. And I tried to give her way more attitude. She's a cop's daughter. She's going to be tough. She's in one of the episodes, she's the one where everybody's getting replaced by robots. She and Batman are on the roof, and she's trying to convince him to help her, and he won't. And in the scene as I wrote it, he turns to leave, and she grabs hold of his cape. And he turns back and looks at her, and she says something, and he agrees to help and starts to leave, and she's got his cape. And she says, "You promise?" And he says, "Yes," and she lets go of the cape. In the way it aired, he's the one in control, and he takes the cape out of her hands and kind of leaves her looking like a fool. And I was pretty mad about it. Pretty mad.
Mm. That is so cool, that little behind the scenes. I mean, BTAS is considered to be one of the just a hallmarks of that golden era of animation, with the elegant look to it and the storytelling.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just recently one of my Facebook friends announced that it's on Amazon Prime. That's the staying power.
The look.
BTAS.
Yeah. Well, the look is largely due to Bruce Timm, and Paul Dini was at the absolute top of his writing game. I mean, his Mr. Freeze episode will make you cry. Almost Got Him is. Just, it's worthy of someone like Donald Westlake. I mean, he was just at the top of his game.
So when did you get the Emmy nod?
Oh, Lord, I don't remember. I think the second season. Now, animation is different. It's not, the Emmy at that time was more for the show than for any individual.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it's like a team nomination.
It is. And if you're a freelance writer, you have to write a certain number of scripts, a certain percentage of the total for that season before you got the Emmy. And the season that they won, I missed by one script.
Ah,
yeah.
Still,
well,
it's
all right.
If
I hadn't pushed the guys so hard, because I really felt like the way to be one of the guys is to have larger testicles than they did. And now I know that that is the one thing they won't forgive. If I had been the person I am now, if I had been smart enough to mother them, I would probably be running DreamWorks now. But I was kind of an arrogant brat, so.
It was the 80s, as were we all. Were we all.
Yeah.
But you saying you have approximately 200 scripts that were produced in half-hour animation, correct?
Yes, yeah. Well, at that time, it was raining soup for animation writers. They were hiring people off the streets, like they did me. They were making episodes of everything. I mean, Rubik's Cube, Gilligan's Planet, my personal favorite that I worked on, Potato Head Kids. Some network executive, we were all laughing about it. Some network executive tried to get the animation rights to Pat the Bunny because he didn't realize that it was a tactile educational book. He thought it was about an Irish rabbit.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And you worked on Disney's Gargoyles as well?
Yes. Yes, I story edited a whole bunch of episodes of that. Yes. Yes.
And you also
that
had
was
a script produced in it as well?
18, I believe. I wrote 18 of them.
Wow.
Yeah. I wrote most of the four-parters. City of Stone, The Mirror. I wrote I had a writing partner at the time, Lydia Morano, who was my assistant story editor at Deke, and she also owned Dangerous Visions Bookstore, which is legendary in the San Fernando Valley. But she and I was given a little more than one quarter of the episodes to story edit, And she and I did all of them because the time crunch was so hard. So there are some, we kind of split the credit. There are some that have her name on that she wrote, some that have my name on that I wrote, some where we ghost wrote each other because time crunches and whatever. But I think the first season, of course, I wrote 4 or 5 by myself because I wasn't brought into story edit until the second season.
That's amazing because Gargoyles is another property that's seeing a renaissance in collector world as well.
It didn't get the attention that I feel that it deserved when it was first on because it was airing opposite the O.J. Simpson trial. So we kept getting preempted.
Here's animation versus bread and circuses.
Exactly. And we never got nominated for anything. And but that was the first series where I was allowed to be in the recording studio. So that was
really amazing.
Yeah, normally they don't let writers or story editors be in the recording sessions. I don't know why, but I actually don't know why, but Disney actually required that there be a story editor present. One of the story editors, Carrie Bates, was living in San Francisco, so the three of us, the other three, had to cover his recording sessions. And I remember at one point getting up on Saturday morning, grabbing coffee, going and sitting in a little soundproof room with Jamie, the director, and we called, I should have written down all these names, the actor Keith Davison, who played Goliath. He was doing a play in New York, and he called in and was recording his dialogue from there, and I think Carrie had the flu or something. There was an issue with the dialogue, but I had to rewrite his dialogue on my feet in the moment, which is probably the most fun thing. It was so much fun, so much fun.
And you were the first solo female story editor for Disney?
That's what they told me. And also for Deke, almost 10 years before that. Yeah.
That's
amazing. That's what the Disney, I mean, I didn't set out to do that. It just worked out that way.
So how was it like being a woman in this particular cauldron?
Well, you know, it was good and it was also hard. The thing that saved me is that the people I was working with were also my social circle. So they had to be nice to me or I would tell their wives, you know. They had to treat me well. Anyone outside the circle, it was a lot tougher. When I was working on Starcom, the U.S. Space Force for Deke, there was an executive at Coleco who was so misogynistic that I was not allowed to speak to him on the phone because he thought my name was pronounced Brian, and he thought I was a guy. And if he had known that I was a little, if he had known that I was a little 26-year-old cupcake with braces on my teeth, he would have torn me apart. So I wasn't allowed to talk to him. I wasn't allowed to communicate directly with him, which I think got in the way a little bit. And then another executive, Coleco, after a meeting, I was the only woman in the meeting. I was usually the only woman in the meetings. After the meeting was over, I'm not sure what his reasoning was, but after the meeting was over, he reached out to shake my hand, and I took his hand, yanked me off my high heels, stuck his tongue down my throat, and then said, "It's going to be great working closely with you." And I was utterly stunned. Utterly stunned. The only thing I could think to do was turn around and punch the vice president of creative affairs for Deke, Robbie London, in the chest and say, "Don't you ever try that." And he was like, "Bren." Because he would never have tried that. But yeah, so I got told when I was doing Starcom, I had male writers asking, "How on earth did you get to do a hard science fiction show?" Like, well, obviously,
ooh,
I was hired for my great legs. Yeah. And then when Lydia and I were doing Dinosaucers with Diane Duane, we became aware that there was a rumor going around that all three of us were, or maybe just Lydia and I, were talented, egotistical bitches who had slept our way to the top. So my
We can laugh about this because we've talked about this off screen, you know, because I was in the oil industry in the 80s.
Right.
But did you ever cross paths with Harvey Weinstein?
I did not. I was not anywhere near at that level. But my ex-husband was at Miramax one day, and Harvey Weinstein came in, and Michael was talking to either a fellow writer or a storyboard artist or someone, I'm not sure who, I don't remember, but Harvey Weinstein was showing Brooke Shields around, and all of a sudden, Weinstein came bursting into the office where Michael was and was like, Thai food, Brooke wants Thai food, Thai food, does anybody have any Thai food? And they were eating Chinese food. So they said, well, we have Chinese food. So Weinstein grabbed like a carton of noodles and ran out. The door slammed a beat. The door opens again. He comes back in, grabs the fork out of the other guy's hand and takes it back out. I mean, that's just who he is. I don't know. Maybe if there'd been a girl in there, he'd have grabbed her. I don't know. But I remember Michael coming home and telling me that story, and I thought, well, that's kind of creepy. I'm never going to go anywhere near him.
Definitely, definitely.
Kind of
Are you there?
Also, he gave Brooke Shields a used fork. I mean, that's really gross.
Yeah. Well, and earlier today we were talking about, and you were saying that you could corroborate some of the things about Bill Cosby and what he's like on set.
Not personally, but one of the extremely talented writers who worked on He-Man is a man named Roby Gorin, who is also one of the funniest human beings on the planet. And he wrote for He-Man after I had left the Fat Albert. I was supposed to write for it, but I got pregnant and was two mornings sick, and I had to drop out. But Arthur Nadell paid me in full for a script anyway, which was really nice of him. But Roby was really excited to work on Fat Albert, and the crew at Filmation said, yeah, you won't be so excited after you come to the set. And he did, and Cosby would turn on the charm for the wraparounds they were filming and then treat the crew like crap in between. Just rude, condescending, abrasive. Roby just wrote about this coincidentally on his Facebook page like yesterday.
Put it this way, you weren't surprised with how all this went down?
No, I wasn't. And the sad thing for me, I mean, aside from the horror at the assaults and stuff, is that so many people who get power immediately when there are so many other people who don't. You know, once you've got power, this is a lesson I learned from Diane Duane, who didn't put it into words, but just the way she lived her life and conducted her career. Her basic philosophy, and it's mine too, was when you get to the top, don't look down, reach down. And I saw that. I mean, Edward Asner with his 17 Emmys on, at that point, he's probably got 112 by now, was the sweetest human being when we were on the Gargoyles doing the recording sessions. Tim Curry, who's a freaking legend, is the sweetest man in the world. Jonathan Frakes was as nice as he could be. Most of these, John Rhys Davies is crazy, but he's really nice. So to see someone, the first time I met John Rhys Davies, Lydia and I walked into the recording studio and we nearly fainted and wet our pants because we thought we heard Sean Connery. So it was John Rhys Davies. I stuck out my hand and said, John, I'm Bryn. I'm your story editor on the next episode. And he looked me up and down, then picked me up, threw me over his shoulder and ran out into the parking lot with me. So we got out to the parking lot. we got to the parking lot, and I'm like, well, now what? And he stopped for a minute and said, I don't know, and put me down and went right back into the recording studio.
That is superb. But still, in general, for the women, there was a lot of, you know, go along to get along.
Yeah, you kind of had to pick your battles real carefully. And this is something I talk about. One of the other women who was starting in animation when I was, although she didn't stay long, she went to live action, is Rebecca Parcioffi. I actually took over story editing My Little Pony from her and her writing partner, Marty Pasco, who later showed up on Batman. And the one thing you could not do is cry. You could get angry, but you better keep your voice low. I had no problem standing up to the boys, but they didn't like, you know, they hated me for it. Diane was very diplomatic. She managed. Rebecca took the same course I did, and they hated her for it. But the one thing you couldn't do was cry. After our careers, our TV careers ended, both mine and Rebecca's, we had to learn how to cry.
Wow.
Because it was so automatic to shut it down, because that's weakness, and they will go after you for it.
That's amazing. And now we're talking 80s and 90s here. Let's fast forward a couple of decades, you know, to the enlightened 2010s and talk about Gamergate, because you know a little bit about that as well, don't you?
I do. Well, I ghost wrote a computer game based on the novel Dragon World by Michael Reeves and the late Byron Price. And there may have been, and I also did two children's games that had to do with dinosaurs, but I don't know if Byron ever produced them. So once again, the only girl in the room, and it's like, okay, we're breaking for lunch. Bryn, can you? No, I can't. No, I'm not the secretary. I'm not going to do that. My daughter is actually a third generation gamer, because my mother used to play video games. But she's a professional in the industry, as are most of her friends. And it's tough. They just, a lot of guys, I don't say men because they're not men, they're little boys in big hairy bodies, are threatened by women. They don't want them there. I mean, the whole Gamergate, going after Zoe Quinn the way they did, because some guy got his feelings hurt, you know, attacking her professional credentials was heinous, but slut shaming, claiming she was sleeping with people, all this other stuff. It was just insane. I couldn't believe it was happening when I was reading news reports. And my daughter and her friends tell me that, you know, you tend to find your tribe and your people who are going to support you. But in the industry overall, it's a tough place to, you know, to wander in without a penis.
Now, would you say, given your experiences and what you know of your daughter's experiences, would you say it's tougher now, better now, about the same?
I would say that it's tougher now, because back in the day, you'd be working with eight guys, and one would be an ass. And maybe of the remaining ones, there'd be two or three who quietly supported you, and the rest just stayed out of it. Nowadays, you've got them banding together on the internet and on social media and doxing people and making personal threats. I was never threatened with anything. I yelled at, but I yelled back. But I didn't have to deal with rape threats or people publishing my address and hoping that I would suicide. I mean, I think it's a million times harder now, which is why it's so important for women to support each other and band together.
Definitely on that one. So now, you say you're still writing. What are you writing these days?
For money, I'm just doing our articles for basically a content farm. So it pays decent. I've got a couple works in progress. I will be moving to Toronto soon. And if I can get a work visa up there, my fella, Ken, who is a professor at Ryerson University and an award-winning animation writer, we are hoping to develop and pitch some animated series up there. My Hollywood creds, even though they're so old, apparently in Canada that they still mean something, and Canada doesn't have the bizarre ageism. Ken knows animation writers in their late 60s who have been working since their 20s and are still working. So that's kind of an awesome thing.
Trust me, you sell yourself short. Your animation creds, particularly the portfolio of shows that you worked on, because as a purveyor of pop culture, which is how I earn my living, I can tell you that this particular portfolio is about as hot as it gets.
Well, I will tell you this, and not in the service of name dropping, just because this was my reality. It's really hard to get a swelled head when your social group, the guys who came to dinner, the people that you saw at every party you went to, included people like Robert Crace and George R. R. Martin. So it's a little hard for me to get a swelled head. And Diane Blaine,
I'm sorry.
And Todd McCaffrey.
I guarantee you, I could take you to a writer's convention and go, and Bryn here wrote Transformers, and be like, they'd be like, you know, twitching in place. So do not ever sell yourself short. I would love when things settle down for you a little bit more, particularly if you start working on this new series, I would love to have you come back on and talk more about this, because this just pleases my geeky little heart. Would you come back?
I would come back, and also if you care to, my friend Rebecca worked on Max Headroom in the new Twilight Zone, and was a woman in live action in the 80s and 90s, and I had lunch with her yesterday because she lives here in Phoenix, and she said she'd be happy to tell you all about what it was like being the only girl in the writer's room.
Yeah. Absolutely. I will ask you to engineer an introduction on that, and we could you can both come back on anytime you want to and just basically dish old war stories. I'd love it.
That would be hilarious.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on. And like I said, we're not done talking about this yet. You have hit one of my favorite things. And I have another friend who's going to be coming on at some point. He's with Pixar, and we're going to be talking about what he's worked on too, because I fully believe that storytelling is multimedia.
Yes,
and there is, you know, it's not just the printed word, it's not just the computer screen. Storytelling is storytelling, no matter how you do it, and I'm fascinated by all of it. So thank you so much for coming on tonight.
You're welcome. Anytime. Thank you for having me.
All right. I shall talk to you soon. And I want to remind everybody that this broadcast is owned and copyrighted by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. And you can follow the Blue Plate Special on Facebook to stay up to date with the hottest writers fresh off the grill. And with that, I'll say goodnight to everyone. Thank you.